Welcome back to another edition of the Exchange Podcast. We're excited today to have the leader of Her Majesty's official opposition, Robert Mitchell, leader of the Liberal Party. He's a father, a grandfather, a community volunteer. He's made a lot of commitments to public service, even outside of politics, former cabinet minister, and now leading his party into what could be a potential election. We don't know when. I kind of thought it might have been earlier in January, right after the Conservative Leadership Convention, but that seems to be deferred. And I would suggest, based on my observation, probably want to defer that quite a while. So you may not be going to the polls soon. But Robert, give us just an introduction of yourself and your background, and we'll have a conversation.
Well, thanks, Blake. And it's great to be with you here today. I guess my background starts back in rural Prince Edward Island in a little community called Fort Augustus.
Okay, know it well.
I grew up in my parents' general store there. That's where I learned probably most of the characteristics that I have with me today. I learned how to deal with the public. I learned how to be my math skills were learned adding up bills in the store, and just how, you know, my parents instilled in me community service,
yeah,
public service, and you make sure everybody gets, you know, what they need. And in our case, it was perhaps groceries and gas when they had no money in their pocket, yeah. Allow for them, you know, for their families to survive. And I learned that young. And we started working in our community store there. I had five siblings and myself. We started working in that store. I did when I was 12 years old. And, I think it created the foundation for me, you know, for all of the years and a deep involvement in public service.
So you come from an entrepreneurial background, business background, you're raised in that environment. You know, when I think of entrepreneurship and the ability to make do with less, watch your bottom line, make sure that your money you come in is not greater, you know, at least balances to the money that's going out. In politics, that seems to be an equation that is not always adhered to. So you were most recently a member of Wade McLaughlin's government, minister in that portfolio in that government. At that time, there's a balanced budget. Today, we don't have that luxury. And as a province, you know, if you were to come in as a leader, as a premier, how do you manage the expectations of the public in what has become an unusual environment where the amount of spending has far exceeded not only the current inflows, but any future possible inflows?
So, you know, based on my years inside government at the time, under two premiers, and when we left in 2019, I was extremely proud that we were leaving a surplus inside their government coffers, which, you know, when a new government comes in, it's important that they have a good place to start from. And I was proud of that when we walked out the door that they would find themselves in that kind of a situation. You know, as I perhaps was not watching as carefully as I could have been for those few years that I was away, but when I decided to come back, you know, I would have never dreamed a $400 million deficit was even possible. And people say that to me today. Why would you come back when it was that? I said, I never would have thought in 6 or 7 short years they could take it from a small surplus to $400 million in deficit with, you know, you can only look at it as incredible, reckless spending, no fiscal responsibility at all. But I mean, you know, that's what's facing us today. So that's what we, as a government, hopefully during the next general election, you mentioned about some timelines. I thought in my heart of hearts that the election could have been last fall. Right. You know, Rob Lance was taking the premier's chair temporarily, 3-4 months, somebody new would come along, and then shortly after that, they would look for their full 4-year mandate. So I would have thought last fall, but then when that didn't occur, I said, well, maybe this spring. Again, I never would have thought they were going to try to ride this out, especially with a $400 million deficit now that they have to explain to Islanders. We, you know, I asked the people that work in the office to do a bit of a deep dive into special warrants. It looks like in over the last 12 months, there were, I think it was 34 special warrants went through, you know, unbudgeted, undebated on the floor of the legislature, 34 special warrants at a value of $372 million. That is incredible.
So it's probably comparable to the budget that you were working with We've got a couple of $1 billion sort of operation now provincially. In the span of a couple of years since you've been out of politics, I mean, the scope of the budget has increased, the scope of the spending's increased. If you had known the fiscal conditions of the province today, would you have still offered service? You're a man of, your vocation seems to be service of others, but would you still have wanted the job that you have today, knowing the situation that we're in?
Well, you know what? I would have had to give it considerable thought. But knowing me at the end of the day, I probably would have said yes, stuck my hand up and rolled up my sleeves and said, we're going to find a way to get out of this $400 million deficit. When I left at Health PEI, or the health budget, when I left in 2019 after the election, it was sitting around $700 million.
Okay.
Today, it's $1.3 billion. And you know what? I could appreciate that if I saw a better healthcare system in Prince Edward Island today than when I left, but that's not the case. It's much, much worse. You know, you say, well, where has the increased dollars going? It kind of looks like it went into administration salaries and bump ups and special expenditures for them.
And maybe exit costs of people.
Exit costs.
Been a lot of rotation in that.
All of that type of thing, which, you know, that's not responsible government. That's not strong leadership. That is the opposite. It's very poor leadership. And, you know, that's where we face today. That's where Islanders are faced today. And this is not something that, you know, can be addressed by one generation. This is going to have to take multi-generations to get control of this.
You're a grandfather. You've got little grandchildren. When you look at the future that we, and I include all of us in that conversation, so whether I personally was involved in spending this money, I'm responsible. I elected governments that took that upon themselves to spend at this level. What do you say to the future generations and the legacy that, you know, you as a legislator are leaving? And, you know, how is there, if you came in, became premier, can you get us on a track? Is it even possible? That's a difficult question, but who can get us on the track? And is it austerity? Does the province respond well to those kind of austerity requirements? Because we have overspent considerably. I'm concerned about the legacy we leave for future generations, and I don't have grandchildren, but you do, and that's got to be a concern.
It absolutely is, and you know, I've said it many times that, you know, some of this debt now is going to be passed down to my grandchildren,
sure,
and probably my great grandchildren if I'm still living when they come on board. The question is, can we get this under control? It's imperative that we get this under control. We need to make some significant changes. Austerity, yes. We need to look at any kind of expenditures that have been going on that we can, you know, relax on. Yeah,
sure.
Recheck and make some changes there. This is not a legacy that I want to leave as a potential premier of Prince Edward Island, to leave this, you know, to future generations. We will find ways to you know, rein things back. I don't think it's the first time it's ever happened to a Liberal government on Prince Edward Island where we come into a worse fiscal situation than we kind of anticipated. So
every government kind of comes in and says, okay, you left us with a mess. And they'll continue to blame that government for a period of time.
Absolutely.
And that's the nature of the game, the game politic, I guess, that we're all kind of observing. But you know, I think now, as you mentioned earlier, it's a time to roll up your sleeves and evaluate things. And even if you weren't expecting it coming in, and that's, I guess, the mark of a leader, you're going to inherit a situation. And we don't know when the next election will be. This could change based on historical precedent over the last 7 or 8 years. It's probably not going to get better. Mm. But what kind of changes can we make? And you manage some big portfolios. The biggest one we have today in the province is health. And you mentioned a $1.3 billion expenditure. There have been comments on the disproportionate weighting of administrative cost to frontline healthcare delivery. I think in the House this week, you made a motion that your party did on supporting frontline healthcare delivery.
Right.
But without the fiscal capacity, and if we can't rely on the federal government, so I'm concerned about the changes in the economy. And, you know, we do have a pretty high reliance on federal transfer payments. They may compress. I'd expect that they will. Interest rates could rise. We are in an inflationary environment. If interest rates go up, it costs more to service the debt, which is now significant, meaning less money for things like roads and education and healthcare. So we're not only dealing with the mess we've created ourselves, but we're dealing with these external factors that are further compressing our financial flexibilities. I don't think I'd want your job, nor probably any governing person today, even if you created this mess. It's a really difficult environment, and I think we need strong leadership to address it. Yeah. So is there an approach? Is it bipartisan? Can you attract the right candidates in your party to help find ways to raise funds? I mean, we've got a big defense contract that I don't think we're properly capitalizing on. There's probably funding there we can use back to your entrepreneurial roots to grow the economy. But it is a real challenge.
And I absolutely agree with you. And, you know, when I think about what you're speaking of, yeah, federal transfers, I think we'll see those decline over the coming.
We should be forecasting it because.
Yeah. And I think the biggest aspect of this, as I look back over the last number of years as a government, as a strong leader, sometimes the answer has to be no. It can't be yes every time for every case, for every project, for every plan that's brought forward. And in what I look, when I see what I'm looking back now over the last number of years, every answer was yes. Mm-hmm. That's why we're $400 million in deficit. That's why, you know, we're heading to a $6 billion or $8 billion debt over the next while, because, you know, not every project you can move forward with. You can put it into your queue. You can, you know, if you look at a 5-year capital kind of budget, you maybe have to expand that out to over 10 years. Right. But there are ways that we can get this under control. And I think it's going to take depreciation of Islanders. It's going to take the understanding of Islanders that this is not sustainable. If we keep on this path, it's not sustainable.
You're out talking to Islanders. If you don't get their support for these kind of changes, you know, it's just not going to end well for anybody. But from your conversations in the field with Islanders, are they willing to accept that we're in a dire fiscal situation? So the one thing, we've got this call-in program, which you might be aware of, and some of the feedback we're hearing directly from Islanders is they're concerned about their finances. Everybody's compressed with the price of gas, milk, groceries are expensive. To have a, you know, a very frank and honest conversation with Islanders, which is what they deserve, and say, look, we are not in a good situation. Do Islanders really understand? I guess concern is people don't seem to understand debt and deficit and budgeting, and they just want to have security and consistency, and they may not have that in the future. So I think all leaders have to be honest about that. In your conversations, do Islanders understand the fiscal hole we found ourselves in?
Well, I guess, you know, I've been at many, many doorsteps over the last year and many, many coffee shops sitting at tables like this, discussing this very issue with Islanders. The number one concern, and, you know, lots of people think it's, you know, what did you hear? It would have been health, but cost of living is number one. Health, 1A. But cost of living is incredible for families across PEI. You have young families trying to start out who, you know, they might have to run two cars because of their employment. They're trying to either get rent or a mortgage together.
Kids want
to
be in activities.
Kids are in sports and other activities. So that's that group. Seniors, kind of, you know, at the end of their careers and
contributed all their life to PEI.
Their whole life, and now they find themselves with pensions or reduced income. Yep. Are faced now with a magnitude of cost increases that they go, I never dreamed it was going to be like this when I was at this stage of life. Working class families that have two jobs or, right, you know, paycheck to paycheck at best, if they can get there. So you're right. Are they focusing on the situation of the government? Maybe not. But when I have these kind of conversations with them, and I tell them, you know, what my vision is and the vision for Prince Edward Island, and it's the vision to remain Prince Edward Island,
right,
first of all.
If
you know,
we can maintain our sovereignty,
yeah,
or so
we'll be very lucky. But, you know, if our debt continues to balloon and grow, mm-hmm, you're going to have to look at something else down the road, perhaps. So let's check on that. But to explain to them that, you know, we're going to have to make some serious, serious decisions here that's going to take, you know, strong leadership with a strong team supporting it all the way through in 27 districts of Prince Edward Island. But, you know, when you explain to them that some of things may look a little differently, you look at other provinces, they're talking cuts. Yeah. To major cuts to programs and inside the governments,
they're talking tolls,
they're talking tax increases. Nobody wants to hear that, absolutely not. but we want to be sustainable, and we want to ensure that when you need a program, it's there. Yeah. And when you need a good healthcare system, it's there. When you need a good education system, it's there. So it's those conversations to indicate to folks, look, we're in a really bad situation, or just like perhaps you were inside the right. your four walls of your house.
Well, government might be worse because they overspend.
That's right.
More than what they bring in.
You go back to reckless spend. We can't. Islanders are not reckless spending inside the four walls of their home.
Nobody
they don't
can do
have that.
That.
So now it's time to convince them that what has occurred has been totally wrong, and we got to get back to responsibility, and we want to make sure PEI is always PEI. So help me out here, and you know what? The buy-in over the last to that message has been incredible. We didn't realize it was that bad, Robert.
Right.
We never would have guessed that we've got to this level, especially when, you know, it's hard to nail down the complete value of the federal transfers that come to PEI and plus extra.
Yeah, so probably half of what we,
I ask people, can you show me what any good out of all of this debt that we received made a difference in your life? I can never. The answer is never clear
measurable.
To me. Yeah, measurable. So, I mean, I think people, they're understanding, but they're so consumed with their own personal lives that they will be supportive, first of all, hopefully at the ballot box when we do get to an election, and secondly, understand that, you know, these are difficult decisions that need to be made and managed, but I think the support will be there when the time comes for that.
Yeah, well, we need strong leadership for sure. That's always critical for our governance. One of the things you mentioned was your team. And if you're going to go to the ballot box, which we're going to, nobody knows when, but at the discretion of the sitting government, we'll within the next 18 months or so, one would assume, you started to do some nominations in districts. So clearly you're getting prepared for something. And it's hard to engage people often without more clarity on when the election will be, because you can't, if you've got a job, it's hard to hang out there waiting for an election call, which you have no control over. You've had a couple of, there has been some by-elections, several in the last year, presumably some more, maybe before an election is called. Why don't we talk about those? So there's one in District 9 that you were successful with, and District 2, which you ran a very close campaign, but didn't get a seat in the House. So, talk about District 9 and what you see in the horizon for upcoming, nominations and who's kind of showing some interest in joining you in the party. Yeah.
Well, first, I'll make a comment on District 9 is what District 9 yielded to the Liberal government or the Liberal party inside the rails of the House as an opposition is an incredible, incredible candidate with a ton of experience inside the bureaucracy of the government system, but connected to her community, connected to the riding that she lives in, and just an unbelievable understanding of, you know, the needs of that community. We're so fortunate that she came forward, stepped up, and decided to put her name forward. So Carolyn Simpson has been an unbelievable candidate to support our four as our fourth candidate inside the rails of the legislature. I had the good fortune, I guess, at the time to be running in the leadership campaign as one of two candidates. Mm-hmm. And because of that, would often get the invite, do you want to come knock on the doors with me? Which I did. I took advantage of that
during her
campaign period. And what I saw, when I saw Carolyn performing at the door or offering, you know, what her vision was, and, you know, we collectively in a by-election, you don't have the strong platform pieces that you do in a general election.
Yeah.
And to explain to residents, how she would improve make their life better.
Yeah.
And the way she just talk to people was amazing. And, you know, we've seen the results. Here's another characteristic of Carolyn. She came out early and said, I want this position, ran in the nomination early, like I think it was October, November, and knocked on the doors, I'm going
to
say, probably three times over that campaign.
It's such a short period that if you're not visible in the community, it's hard to resonate.
You absolutely do. And she took advantage of that time, which, you know, I guess it's incredible how she put her entire life on hold and got to the door over and over and over. And, you know, by the end of it, I think, you know, I was with her one door and they said, is it you again? Get out of here. You already got my vote. Right. That's the kind of connection you need to make with people. And she did it. She did it in spades. And she continues to do it right now. She's in her second session in the legislature. Yep. And she's, you know, she's incredible. She stands up. It's compassion. It's, you know, empathy, all the things that she needs to show her district. I have your back. And she does it on a daily basis.
So it's good success for you in District 9 and long held Tory seat, formerly by Natalie Jameson.
Yes.
Cabinet minister. District 2. That's an interesting one. So long held Tory, like almost impenetrable fortress. Mike Curry held that seat for many years. Stephen Myers held that seat. Stephen Myers, EA at the time. Brendan Curran was kind of the anointed representative to run in that riding. Watching that election or that by-election on the evening unfold, it was pretty close. I mean, you're somebody who has, you know, Fort Augustus is close, but it's not in the heartland.
Right.
You clearly had a good organized campaign because you performed very well. Tell me a little bit about that experience and the process. And, you know, it would have been ideal, perhaps, to sit inside the rail as a leader of a party. It's not necessary. Rob Lance sat outside the rail. Wayne Crew sat outside the rail. It is difficult. And I'm sure you're looking for other opportunities to get inside the rail. But let's talk about District 2 and how that went. And then let's look at other upcoming by-elections.
Well, look, for me, when I decided I was to put my name forward to run for leadership, my goal was to win the leadership, but it's to get inside the rails of the legislature as quickly as I could. You know, I talked earlier about I would have potentially thought a fall election was imminent last fall with a new leader.
Yep.
That wasn't the case. So what did happen, and I didn't expect it when I was, you know, going through my leadership, was that Stephen Myers would step away, creating this potential for a by-election down there. You know, a district that's been 35 years held conservatively. You know, you named it like Mike McCurry, good MLA, Stephen Myers, good MLA. You know, there was really the potential there of flipping to a Liberal Party may not have been great, but I have my hand up instantly that I wanted to do this. And believe me, at the early days, I might have been the only one that thought, good idea, Robert. But the more I talked to people, and I did have people that said, that's crazy. Like, you're going down
the heartland.
Yeah, you're
going
to go down there and you're going to get really beat badly. And I said, look, if I don't show that I'm a leader that will take a risk, will put in I think I probably worked four times harder in that by-election than I would in my own. And we started early. We worked late. We got to, with the exception maybe of the last day, this bit of a storm on there.
Yes.
I think I missed about 10 houses on a rope, but I tried to get to every house inside the riding and I worked hard at it. And it didn't come with objection at the start. I told this story the other night at the Lawrence McCauley tribute dinner. One of my calls was, I said, Lawrence, I'm going to call Lawrence. He'll give me support on this.
Yeah.
The thing was, Robert, you can't do that. So even the party, you know, our executive were, I don't know if this is a good idea. But when I got a couple people to believe in me and understand that I'm ready to put in the work here, this is going to be, I'll work as hard as I can.
Yeah.
And get out. And, you know, I'll take advantage, like, because of my Fort Augustus upbringing and when I lived, even when my kids were young, you know, my connection to Pownell Rink, mm-hmm. my connections to baseball fields in Vernon River and all the area down in Georgetown, Cardigan. I knew a lot of people when I got knocking on the doors and they knew me. So it wasn't a complete, you know, stranger.
It was a courageous decision to try to take on that seat at that time, which you almost were successful
at. Well, we took it from 1,700 margin or 1,800 margin down to 105, which
right. That's pretty significant.
I'm proud of that. You know, I'm proud of what I did, but I'm even more proud of the team that worked with me, showed up every day, get in the car with me. Some of them came to the doors with me. Some of them were making calls for me. Some of them were making sure that, you know, if we were doing advanced polling, they were out there doing it. It was, incredible. And, you know, I always say to my team in elections, and this was an even bigger team with new players that I hadn't had before, at the end of the week, we kind of reevaluate. And, you know, we got a lot of work done. But did we have any fun? We gauge it by the fun we had, yeah. And everybody was happy to be there. We were having fun. And you know, it doesn't seem like incredible work when you're having fun, when you got the right people, all with the same vision, getting to the doorsteps, meeting people. And then not every doorstep was incredibly friendly, as you can imagine.
Well, and you've got some people that probably haven't seen a lot of liberals kind of.
Well, especially down in one area there, you mentioned it was Brennan did well in the Georgetown poll.
Yeah, the last poll that
reported. So that was a challenge for me in that particular poll.
Yeah.
But otherwise, it was friendly. It was, you know, we had great conversations, and for the most part, I felt proud of the result. Even though I didn't win, everybody says when you come that close and take that margin down like that, consider it a win. So at the end of the day, I consider it a win, but when I'm outside the rail and I'm looking in at Brandon Kern sitting in the chair and I'm still outside, it's a frustrating time for me.
Yeah, so, well, and there could be some more by-elections come up.
There could possibly be.
There has to be by fall. So whether there's a general election or some by-elections, you know, politics moves quickly, and it moves quickly in this province.
It does.
Why don't we take a quick break for sponsorship? And we certainly have opportunity for sponsors. If anybody wants to join our podcast, we'd love to hear from you. We'll take a quick sponsorship break. We'll come back and we'll talk about some other aspects of PEI and how it relates to your governance and your plans for the future.
Thank you.
This episode of the Exchange Podcast is brought to you by Labormine, your workforce intelligence solution. Stop reacting, start stabilizing with Labormine.
Welcome back again. Thanks for joining us on the Exchange Podcast. We're delighted to have with us today Robert Mitchell. He's a leader of the official opposition, leader of the Liberal Party, and building up or rebuilding the party from a couple of elections where, you know, through the normal cycles of governance, parties ebb and flow. And he stepped into an opportunity to be leader of an incumbent party. The party's growing. You've added another seat just recently in a by-election. Let's get back to what's going to happen for an election and the level of interest that you're seeing. You've got four candidates in the House. Is that
we do
correct?
Have four.
So,
yes.
You know, there's 27 seats. You've got a couple of people nominated. What's the level of interest to be involved in politics today? And are you getting people from communities that have credibility and interest to join your movement? And how's that standing? How do you kind of navigate the fact that there may be interest, but you don't know when they're going to actually get to the doorsteps?
Yeah, so those are all excellent points, and they're points that face me every day or at the moment. To start off with, we now have three incredible candidates that have gone through the nomination process, Parker Grimmer, Andrea Greenan, and Anastasia DeRoche, are out.
Which districts are those?
So that's 24 Anastasia's, yeah. And Evangeline Mascouche.
Okay. And that's a troubled one these days.
It's a bit of one these days, and I know she is out, talking to people in her community to gauge kind of a feeling of how they feel about things, and that feedback is coming to us, and we bring it to the floor of the legislature as we've done the last couple of days, and we'll continue to do that over the coming weeks. But she's out there working; she's knocking on doors. Andrea Greenan, who is a retired nurse in our healthcare system, with a very strong vision of, you know, how our health system has evolved over 40 years that she's been part of the process. So brings a valuable, incredible foresight into our healthcare system as it exists today and as it existed years ago. And she's out working, knocking on doors and driving up clay driveways and doing all the things that you need to do. And then in just 10 days ago, Parker Grimmer in one of the Sherwood ridings is been nominated, super candidate, you know, well connected to the community, principal of Sherwood School, incredible gentleman,
education
background with the school board system and principal system, and so he's offering incredible support to us, you know, and not only the education file, but in our financial, the world of how you're supposed to do business financially, yeah. and work within your means. So these three people, we're so fortunate to have them, and you know, obviously when I begin my discussions with other candidates, and we have many that, you know, because of their employment or various reasons, have to wait till an election is imminent, and that's not today. But for, you know, people that I've been dealing with, and I always begin with my discussions with, look, to me, I ran in 2003, and I felt like I was carrying bags of bricks up a hill. But I ran in 2007, and this feels like 2007. Momentum has come our way.
Why is that? So what is the change in the short span? Like, what do you feel in the community when you talk to people that the there's a different attitude, I guess, amongst the electorate?
Yeah, well, I think you hit on it a little bit earlier. Politics and PEI ebbs and flows. Mm-hmm. You know, they'll work with you.
It's all about timing.
It's all about timing, and Islanders will stick with you till they don't believe in what your message is, don't believe in how you're running government, see you getting complacent, and all of those things, they come to play. It's a political cycle. You know, I'm not making this up. People in Prince Edward Island know this. So in 03, for me, that's where the government of the day, the Pat Binns government, was still pretty successful. We're, you know, maintaining most of the support from Islanders. But in 07, shifted completely. And that's where we are today. It shifted completely from the Dennis King government to the Rob Lance government.
So if you're talking to progressive conservatives across the aisle, I'm sure they'd feel pretty confident about where they're positioned and the good work they're doing. Do you think they'd feel the same about change?
Well, you know what? I don't know, but I do know this. When you're inside that bubble, you get a little nearsighted and in your own box. And you know what? I guess maybe I was guilty of that back in 2019. Sure. Did I think it was going to go the way it did? Probably not. You're so close to the
right
situation that you don't,
chamber.
Yeah, you don't see, right. You know, the peripheral vision is not there.
Yes.
But for me, the peripheral vision is there. Islanders are coming to me. Conservatives are coming to me that are, you know, not really happy with what they see today. So that's a telltale sign. Okay. Things are shifting. Momentum is coming towards us, and you don't want to lose the, you know, that feeling of momentum, of tide shifting, you know, of things significantly changing, which is why, you know, a spring election would have been perfect.
So now, which is why you probably won't get one.
Well, yeah. So now it's incumbent upon me to keep, you know, to keep the message clear that we are ready.
Yeah.
We have a focus. We have a platform. We've listened to you for a number of months now, and we'll continue to listen to you, and we'll continue to build and add to the platform piece. I know there's a lot of people go, well, you know, what's your platform today? Well, our platform is evolving, and you know, is it the same this week as it was last week? No. And should it be? No. We need to add on new pieces and change it and I'll say massage it to what's going on this week.
Right.
And there's a lot of things happening this week inside government.
It's been a busy week for government and not a rewarding one for many.
No, it's not. And, you know, I think we need a lot of clarity brought to a situation that occurred that maybe people are scratching their heads about and saying, well, what the heck's here? We've tried to portray exactly what happened, you know, what has happened there. And, you know, the government of the day, they're trying to defend an incredibly poor situation here. And I think Islanders see through all of that noise and will...
In the fullness of time, all will come out if there's anything there.
Absolutely.
I'm sure that it will be disclosed. And you can't really hide from things too well in the public sphere. So
no, it's, you know, people look at things very closely, especially when it's, you know, close to your neighborhood. So that's where Jill's future holds, right inside the boundaries of District 24. And we'll see where that gets to.
And whether he's doing good work for his constituents as portrayed or whether there's something else, but we'll let that evolve and see where it ends up. I want to shift gears back to something briefly that we did talk to Sean, which is health. So you're a former Minister of Health. And under Robert Giz, I think the Health Board, Health PEI, came in as an arm's length body that would administer health on PEI. When you were Minister of Health, you had some challenges. Your board that was independently representing that governance body resigned.
Yeah.
That's happened again. So I think with Alex McBeath, maybe under your tenure, the board had decided that they just weren't making the progress. Later, under the current government, you know, the leadership and the board also resigned. You know, when I step back and I look, as a simple islander, I'm kind of confused with why we've got this independent and redundant entity that's very expensive to administer. And then we've got another functioning part of government, the Department of Health and Wellness. Mm. To me, I see it as, well, for sure there's redundancy because they're both doing the same thing in many cases. The intention is probably correct and great, where you've got some, you know, distance from the maybe meddling of government in the affairs of health delivery, but that's never really probably, you know, worked out. And as recently as the current CEO, who's just, I guess, been asked to dismiss her position, that conversation seemed to happen from government and not from the board. So a couple of questions in your experience. Do we still need to have this, again, my words, redundant bureaucratic system that overlaps with what's happening under the ministerial's direction? Is there actually separation? And is it time to just say, look, this is a failed attempt and we need to have, if the government wants to manage healthcare, which they seem, always seem to under any government, let's let them do it and take responsibility for it. You know, if I were governing and I had that body, I'd probably say, keep me the heck away from it. I don't need to be interfering. It's a difficult portfolio. Let the professionals provide direction. But governments seem unable to kind of keep their arms out of it. So you've gone through it. You see what's happening today. What would a good approach to managing healthcare and PEI be? And could you do something different?
Yeah, well, I guess a term that we've been hearing a lot about in the last few days and this week and probably will next week is good intentions. And I do believe that maybe the structure of the health PEI and Department of Health.
Would the family physicians agree that there's good intentions?
Well, let's put it this way. Day one, back in whatever year that was, 2007 or 8 or what, I can't even tell you the exact date. I think the intentions were thought to be good.
And the concept is good.
Yeah, the concept is good. I guess that's where we'll agree on the concept. You know, I'll take it back to my experience, right? When I got in the chair, and I wasn't there for a long time, I think it was January of 2018, January 8th or something like that, until election of May in 2019, that was my tenure in health. I went in with, you know, excited to be Minister of Health, going to make some change. Well, not changes, but make sure the direction is, you know, where it needs to be. And, you know, there was a structure of Health PEI that had the CEO and then the board. And, you know, I understood that the CEO was selected by the board and board gave direction, you know, of the workings of Health PEI there. But there was always, and it said it stayed in legislation, the policy would be directed by government. And
implemented by a professional.
And implemented by this board. So when I got there, you know, you're happy to meet everybody, and I didn't know everybody on the board. And, you know, I knew the CEO at the time a little bit because he was a former deputy minister. So I was excited to get to a meeting and hear what's going on. Early on in the meeting, there was discussion about, you know, how do we get spending under control in health? And, you know, the mechanism that was being discussed was, okay, on Prince Edward Island, people stay in hospitals too long. We're going to try to move them out 3 to 5 days earlier. We're going to try to free up beds. Yeah. When we get enough beds freed up, we're going to close them. And then what's the next step? Staff will be laid off. And I pretty near fell off my chair when I heard that early on. I said, I'm not familiar with any policy that was driven by that way. We just, you know, we'd come off the doorsteps on the campaign. It wasn't closing beds and laying off staff. It was enhancing, improving, and making our healthcare system
so
better.
So is the board working against the policies of the government?
Well, let's put it this way. And, you know, I wasn't sure. Maybe we didn't make it clear. So I tried to make it clear to, you know, the CEO and the board. But, you know, I found myself then kind of fighting the battle of, well, the CEO was kind of dug in maybe, and they'd send the chair down to tell me, you know, he works for us, not for you, blah, blah, blah. And I go, well, you know, none of this is working for islanders, especially sick islanders that need this care. And so I said, you know, I'm asking you to look at other measures, you know, at a province, anything else inside the health system that we can.
And was the board's direction based on financial control? Like, what was?
Well, I suppose, yeah. Like, I mean, obviously, at that time, we're talking $700 million budget.
Yeah.
You know, and knowing,
to tighten it up.
Yeah, knowing that you can't, you know, you have to find some kind of levers in there that you look to pull for control. But this would be the ultimate lever, in my opinion. So I said, let's look at other potentials. Look at out of province care. Look at any other measures that we can, you know, maybe get control under, and not this at the moment. Yeah, okay. And then you go back, you know, 2 months to the next meeting. And this was still on the agenda. And I go, ooh, this is going to cause a problem for Islanders that need the care, and plus government that's in the power of the day, because this is all going to funnel back up. But no, we're clear. We don't have to, you know, talk to you or answer to you. So, you know, I go back to the department. I go, this is serious to me.
Yep.
And I said, they're not really taking whatever I'm saying as policy piece. They're on a plan that I can't deviate it. So, you know, the decision with officials and myself, well, you're going to have to make some changes so you can at least be part of this discussion, right? Which meant changing some legislation to update it, or at least a change,
yep,
that gave me a little bit of eyesight or ability to sit in to say, this is not good. You know, the argument would come back with, well, you know, we have to keep separate government to Health PI. And I'd say, well, explain to me why. Well, you know, you may call for Mrs. Jones from her granddaughter. She needs to be in a private bed. I said, first of all, that's insulting, because that's not what would be occurring. And secondly, this is a major issue for families in Prince Edward Island whose grandmother's in the hospital and there's nobody at home to watch her for the 3 days. She needs that extra little attention and care. She's getting now. That's why she's getting it. Yeah. And so we made the changes, brought it to the Florida legislation, of the legislator. And I, you know, I told everybody in the floor why this was important. You know, obviously you went through, support for that. And within hours, the board stepped down and vacated. I mean, I was really appreciating all the other pieces of work they were doing. I was wanting them to stay. I made calls to see if they'd come back, but, you know, they just
bridged too far at that.
Well, you know, there were some that said, I'd like to come back, but, yeah, you know, I committed with the other side. So I said, okay, well, I appreciate that. So,
why did government, so, you know, initially instituted as an independent body, mm-hmm, and for sure, there's an obligation of the local politician to support the constituents. So there's always going to be meddling in any, yeah, of these systems to some extent. But, you know, the board was doing its function. It was sort of dictated to. It you know, collapsed or you know, they recused themselves. Your budget was $700 million at that point. It's doubled in about, yeah, 15 years. So, you know, has the oversight of government caused this escalation? And then you look at the leadership of something like Health PI. These positions are about a 2-year rotation. So the whole thing seems really unstable. The board doesn't seem particularly stable. A couple of complete exits under two different governments over, you know, a decade. CEOs rotate on a frequency that is not consistent with any other body of this scale. And even the bureaucracy within, you know, Health PI, there's so many changes there. Either it's a bad place to be or nobody can withstand it. Going forward, if you come in as premier, do you see a need for Health PI and the separation, or should it just be governed under one budget and one management?
So I guess I'll bring it back to an interview that I heard the other day. One of the new board members that came on after we went out and searched for new board members, and they came in, and the question was asked him, you know, was it good? He said, yeah, it was really good. We were working well. We were getting all kinds of things, you know, moving forward, and it worked good until it didn't. They said, when was that? He said, about a year and a half in. So when they came in, they were working on the legislation that I changed, where the minister could at least be, you know, part of the discussions and oversight and all of that. When it changed was when the Green Party stepped back the legislation. They wanted to go right back to the reverse of you know, before it was changed, where it was complete separation, no controls, okay, no vision, no watching over, which is where we are now. You know, that has doubled in 7 years, their budget. That has, you know, the bulk of the money has gone to the CEO and the offices on the top floor over at Health PEI, and moving costs and other expenditures. That's where the bulk of the money has gone, okay, with no oversight from government. However, you know, there was a bit of controls, but that was walked back to complete separation, which, you know, it doesn't serve Islanders, I guess, at the end of the day.
If there's so much money goes to the administration, yeah, of that body, is there enough money going to the front line to support Islanders?
There absolutely is not enough money going to the front line. So that's things that we have to work on. You know, when we look at 27, 28, 30 million, the number's been changing, travel nurses that are coming in to meet our needs on the front line.
So, and there's been special warrants on that, which is a great concern, because we actually do health recruitment in other provinces, and to see that kind of egregious overspending, people are benefiting, but that financial benefit isn't even staying in PEI.
Yeah.
So, yeah, if that's a part of the cost and it's poor planning.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you have to look at, when that's what you're facing, you have to look at doing things differently. I don't think there's been any effort to do things differently, to you know, instead of that 27
or reevaluate.
Or reevaluate.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah. So these are the things that have to be done. But, you know, if you're asking me the question, do I think it needs to be two entities? I do not. I think, you know, we need to be closer connected so that, you know, Islanders know there's accountability. Mm-hmm. They're, you know, we're not just letting spending go out of control, and we're going to try to find ways to improve the frontline service that, you know, the frontline service is watching what's going on the upper level, and they're not happy, and that creates just a toxic atmosphere to work in, and that's part of our issue, and that's part of the discussion I've been having with Islanders all summer. The healthcare system, I don't even want to work there anymore. I can't wait till I'm out of that system. When we have, you know, the smallest population, 180,000, we should have the best healthcare system anywhere in the world, and we should be treating you know, our frontline staff like kings and queens, and listening to them. And that hasn't been going on. And I would like to do that as premier. And I would like to have my health minister be doing the same thing and taking what they're telling you is broken and how to fix it and move maneuvering with that. And that's much better. They're going to get much better outcome from that.
Yeah. There seems to be a lot of, it's moved beyond apathy. It's just almost inconsolable frustration, I think, within the system. And, you know, maybe it permeates back up to the top as the top CEO, or is it somebody within the Department of Health and Wellness? But I don't know how you fix that. So I don't envy you or any leader or the current premier to have to try to manage this, because what it needs is, you know, probably some reengineering.
Yeah. Well, when you look at it today in, you know, accountability, if that finger's pointing that way and the other finger's pointing back there, there's no accountability. Everybody's trying to blame the other side. At least if it comes back to the government, there's your blame. If you're doing it wrong.
Yeah. You're spending the money. You're collecting the taxes.
And in the next general election, you remove that government, based on they're not doing what they're, you know, what they're supposed to be doing for you. It's really simple. It's been going on forever. And, you know, I think you get that buy-in then from the frontline workers that say, look, finally somebody's got my back. They'll listen to me. And I don't think everybody, you know, expects something done instantly. They'll give you information and say, look, you need to implement this over some certain period of time, and they'll work with you on that.
If there's time. I think there's been so much time lost in the process. People are fatigued. And yeah, I think you're going to see attrition, and you're going to see more challenge in the system. But we'll save that for when you get to be leader and premier, and then you can make the changes that are necessary. Let's shift to energy. So it's a big issue. When I look at the costs that everybody's affected with, energy is probably one of the biggest and something nobody has control over. So whether it's the fuel price at the pump or the electrical cost to keep your home operating. On the electrical side, now you've got vast experience from both Maritime Electric side. You're familiar with the transmission and distribution because you have experience between politics working in that sector. You know, from the outside, you know, there's a lot of challenges on how we're administering. We don't really generate much electricity here in PEI. We've got some wind energy, which is great when it works, but it's not 100% reliable. Yeah. There's controversy today on re-implementing a diesel burning sort of redundant source on the Charlottetown waterfront. Just talk about battery storage. You know, going forward, Islanders need reliable access to power. And if you don't have it, then you'll look for other jurisdictions. So for business who pay an even higher rate of electricity than most places in Canada, a rational actor would question whether you want to operate a business in PEI or if you should be elsewhere. How do you give Islanders comfort that energy prices can be managed? And part of the problem is we're consuming electricity from a North American grid on prices that we can't control. Recent increases requested through IRAC include refurbishing of the Pointe-le-Prince, the new diesel generator, the Fiona impact. So there's a whole bunch of additional costs that are going to hit Islanders at a time when they really can't afford the current cost of energy. With your background in energy, how would you approach that as premier? And is there a solution, or are we just at the mercy of conditions beyond our control?
Well, you've hit on a number of conditions that have been, you know, who would have thought that we would, the impact of the hurricane would have been so significant in Prince Edward Island, you know, but that, those weather patterns will continue. So we could have that again next year or the year after, or who knows when. So we have to improve our system. We have to improve our grid. Now, grid reliability and pricing are kind of two different silos today. You know, the pricing is established by a lot of different factors, you know, that are out of control. And IRAC and PEI determines that. And, you know, we've been questioning, and I've been questioning, has IRAC been tasked with a lot of different funnels that they have to look at are they, you know, are they resourced right, or do they have the need to meet all of those things? But electrical pricing is one. Obviously, our grid has been stressed to the max over the last number of years with governments, both federal
and provincial. Getting brownout. We're in a kind of perpetual brownout situation.
That's where we're heading. Like with you know, with programs for heat pumps and electrical vehicles over the last number of years, our system is maxed out.
So is that poorly planned? Or the implementation of these carbon offsetting, you know, strategies not planned well enough that we stress the grid?
Well, maybe poorly planned in the fact that, you know, if you're going to improve your system, that work has to happen about 10 years earlier to know where you're going to be. I look at this in the pricing area. Maybe that's something that we'll have to address down the road to say, you know, and I know there was talk that the shareholders, you know, get 9% return.
That's a Fortis rate return.
But that's a Fortis rate too, right? It's not just PEI that's driving that. So maybe we can do something different here.
Fortis rate is less. The guaranteed, it's not a rate of return, but the guaranteed return on capital is actually less in Newfoundland and it's more in PEI.
Yeah, so that's where we'll have to address.
Okay.
Costing. I guess the main concern for me is the rolling brownouts and blackouts. Yeah. That's something that, you know, it's going to be significant in Prince Edward Island. It will be significant, you know, they're predicting the polar vortexes and hurricanes, you know, coming down the road with the climate change piece and how weather is going to be effective, over the short term. But for Prince Edward Islanders to be in a rolling brownout or blackout situation, you know, that means our hospitals have no power. You know, it means senior homes have no power. It means seniors living at their own homes have no power. It's not situations that we want on Prince Edward Island. They're, you know, we want the robust grid that we can have. And yes, that involves wind, which we were leaders at one point in time, and now we're kind of in the pack. Solar, which we're doing well there, and just 2 nights ago there was a new solar field that's announced up in the west end of PEI. A significant number of solar panels that will be going there with a battery system there too. So that's good, but you know, we need to continue on with those in other areas of the province. So, you know, we have things in place that we need, but I think in the short term, and you know, I've seen presentations, and you know, based on weather of today, back in years ago, and I lived this when I was working at Maritime Electric, our peaks were different than New Brunswick. So okay. We could get by because they had power over there. But now peaks, based on, you know, all the electricity.
Sure, our population's growing. Yeah.
So our peaks are the same. So they don't have it to give to us right. or sell to us when we need it. So we're about 114 or 15 megawatts close. The two gas turbines, you know, I think are significant to aid our situation here. Now, I know they're diesel burning, and that's a concern. It's a concern for me. It's a concern for me. For
is a government who's encouraged islanders to get off fossil fuels. Yeah. So let's get EVs. Well, now to charge your EV, if you have one, you're going to be using dirty fossil fuel.
Yeah.
Is there no other alternatives that should be explored?
So I guess with these two machines is what they're looking at. The other option, which we already have three on Prince Edward Island, you know, let's look at natural gas. Let's pursue right. that to, for a cleaner fuel for going there. I know, you know, that's probably something we should look at, whether it's pipe or whether we have the ability. But, you know, Irvin brings in compressed natural gas every day. Yeah.
Consistently 24 yeah. hours a day, yeah. but could we get a pipeline from that terminal point?
That's what we would work at, you know, and oftentimes you hear, oh, you're not big enough, you're not this. Well, you got strong leadership at the top, you make
things
work.
And if the
work.
Price justifies that investment, yes. then, you know, can the province even make the investment that's required in our current fiscal situation?
Well, I mean, that's the discussion we have to have. I guess, you know, step one is we don't want to be without power. When we need power.
And you
right?
need it in the middle of winter. It's not going to be
It's going to be the coldest days of the year, of probably, that yeah. you're going to be looking for this. So, you know, if you had it there. And the other part of it, when you talk about fossil fuels, these are peaking units. They don't run normally. That's why you have battery banks and solar panels and wind continuously putting in so that, you know, all of that can maintain. These are crunch times when you maxed out the line, there's no power anywhere else. And in my opinion, because I was one of only a few Maritime Electric people that got to go out on the barge in 1997 when the potato boat cut the cable.
Okay.
And, you know, we were 31 days. Getting that cable repaired, it was a huge big deal. Load was of a level at that time that we could run on one.
Right.
So you know, but it was on one with our Charlottetown plant that just had come on that day. So you know,
we don't have much redundancy.
We were lucky there. Yeah. So you know, to know, you know, the situation that, you know, who knows what can happen. It would under the water. Yep. In my opinion, the generation needs to be on Prince Edward Island. So it's here when we need it here.
Yeah.
And so these are things that I'd be working with federal government, with Maritime Electric, with governments maybe in New Brunswick or even Nova Scotia to evaluate that we have the power system here. But I don't think, you know, any islander wants to be without power for half an hour or an hour when it's minus 40 and blowing right. outside. So, yeah. So I think that's, you got to go back to meet your needs first. If it's a diesel start, well, we'll look at trying to, you know, get over to some, the natural gas system, whether it's compressed, whether it's pipeline. I'm not willing to take no for any answer ever. So, oh, we can't do a pipeline. We probably can. Let's delve in there and get working on that.
Sounds like we're getting some policy initiatives maybe here for this next election. But
you may be, and maybe I'll get my hand slapped by people and say, what are you giving all your secrets away for?
You know what? Yeah. Any good ideas are probably will be, you know, considered for any. But let's look at another portfolio that you were administering when you were, you know, in government and you're returning back to government. So a lot of topic and conversations around land use in your former minister of land. I mean, we've got a very precious little sandbar in the middle of the Atlantic,
yeah.
and it's eroding. So we're losing land every year to natural forces. You mentioned that the natural forces might increase and might accelerate our erosion. And there's also controls in the amount of land that can be managed and owned. And the regulator, which is IRAC, mm-hmm. looks after and controls that. You know, in your time as Minister of Land, Environment, what would you say needs to happen to protect and, you know, maintain the integrity of our land? And as a person, so I used to have a retail store in Cavendish, and I'd travel out every day across these beautiful vistas. Rationally, people are also enjoying those vistas and putting homes on them. So they the management of land use is changing, and our farmland is kind of changing. As a agricultural province, that is a concern. Once that land is developed, you don't get it back. And I'm a big proponent for development. I'd say we probably need more density and less sprawl, but all the issues facing land use today, from ownership to management, what would you do differently in that land portfolio?
So I guess, you know, I thoroughly enjoyed my time when I had communities, land, and environment. All three parts of that portfolio were extremely interesting, and I learned a lot while I was sitting in that chair. You know, I would be concerned, a perfect piece of farmland, like you mentioned, when you're going through the vistas and you see something that's been in agriculture for many, many years, and all of a sudden there's an application for a subdivision that comes in there. And, you know, we look at those seriously, and some of them might not have made the cut, I guess, to put it lightly at the day, and then all of a sudden might there'd be a farmer laying in, sit across from me at the table just like this, and they'd explain to me, they'd say, Robert, I don't have a pension plan.
My kids don't want this.
Well, I don't have a pension plan. My kids don't want this. Yeah. This is my retirement. It's always been my retirement, and now is my chance to sell it at a value where, you know, I, my wife, we can comfortably retire. So you need to make this happen. And, you know, when you look at it objectively and from every angle, they, you know, they're rightly so. That's what they want to do. So, you know, how do you achieve keeping in a farmland and allowing, you know, the owner to get the price? You know, often somebody that looking to buy farmland, and a new farmer in particular, or a young person, they want it as cheaply as they can get it.
That's how you would like to buy it.
That's rational thinking. Yeah. So, I mean, that did not work for the farmer who wants to retire. So maybe, you know, what things that worked back in the 70s, we have to revisit there. I know at the time it was land banks, but
I was going to ask about that.
Even today, you know, land, I'm not sure what the term they call it was, land loans, right? Where, right, you know, the person has this much money, but they,
it's,
you know,
backed by the province.
Yeah, it's backed by the province, and it gives a new farmer a chance to get in and get going. So the land bank worked back in the early days, and maybe a land loans can work today. Yeah, and I think that's probably where we got to get there. We can't just tell people they can't sell their property,
their
asset, right?
It's like a government. So too much oversight and intervention. It's a difficult situation. Well, I guess this is what we elect our government.
It's difficult. And you know what you need to do? You need to talk to the individuals involved and see if there a workable solution that will work for you, but it will work for the young person looking to buy it, and come to terms on that. When you talk further about land, and I know there's a lot of concern for down the east end of the province as to what's happening there.
When you bring
it back to you know, the regulator of whose oversight is the land sales, and, you know, they're working in a very confined box. You're under your acreage limit. You say what you're going to use the properties for, and, you know, you're an islander for what you've been here for the 365 days.
Yep.
That checks all boxes, right?
Right.
Now, if you're not completely above board with what you're going to do with a farm, and 5 years later it's sitting vacant and everything's growing up, and, you know, it doesn't look like any work is going on there, well, that's going to lead to questions in the community, and that's kind of where things have gone down there. Now, I'm not sure that the mechanism exists in PEI today to manage all of that, and that's why I said early days we need to do a federal invest open public inquiry on what's going on in Eastern Prince Edward Island, and it has to be federal, because you need tentacles that can reach up and explore in places where provincially we can't, definitely IRAC can't, RCMP even can't locally. So, you know, that one's a little bigger
consideration
that will have to happen down the road. But I tell you, like, you know, when you look at other aspects of community and land, with the exception of what's foremost on the floor of the legislature the last couple of days, farmers are great stewards of our land. Developers, you know, always have the best intention of land at hand here. And islanders ourselves want, you know, our land to be treated to the best of its ability. When I was Minister of Environment, we were the number we were looking at then, we were losing a foot 12 inches mm-hmm. off our
through
coastal
erosion
right. sure. through coastal erosion every year. I don't know. I didn't dare ask the number today. Yeah. It's significant.
And there's wind erosion on the farmland too. It's crops.
Yes.
Fertile farmland is migrating.
Yeah. So it's a serious concern, but it's one that can be managed. I think with conversation between those that have it, those that are looking for it, and making sure that our farmers, our needs are being met. That our islanders, there's a place where they can buy fresh vegetables and all that stuff. Yep. So it's a manageable piece. I really truly believe. But like every other portfolio, there's changes. You got to modernize legislation. You got to work with for today, and you got to think outside the box sometime to find the solution.
I'll ask you a last question, then I'll open it up for you. But if islanders are listening to this podcast, and we hope they are, many do, and they're comparing, in an election, a general election, you could have as many as 5 different political parties vying for a voice in the legislature. Today we've got 3. So between the Liberals, the Greens, the Progressive Conservatives, how would you differentiate yourself in that environment? We've seen... I've seen a migration to the center of the political spectrum. And in fact, under Dennis King, the traditional Progressive Conservative Party has probably moved farther left than any government recently. Everybody is kind of clamoring for this center left sort of space. What is it that you bring that would differentiate your government from what we see today?
Yeah. So I guess for me and what I said since day one, heading back in here, my experience from what I saw in the time there, what I've learned, in my entire life, starting at 12 years old in a grocery store in Fort Augustus to, my years at Maritime Electric and the service that I saw there and public service, that's the thing, like my public service and you hit on it earlier, I was out. I was clearly out for 5 years or 5.5 years.
You were free.
And I could have just
come
kept
back
going.
In. It's like an inmate returning to prison.
But it's that call to public service. To stand back and look and not be content with what you see happening and knowing that we could have a different future, a better future. And you don't have to, you don't have to sell the store for it. You just may have to make changes. So, I'm sitting back there watching and I'm looking, I say, I want a real, a province where my grandchildren, have success in, where my great grandchildren will have success in. And that's why I put my hand up. That's why I'm back. Now, that's what I offer to islanders, and I hope they see that. But I will say this, in all my conversations, I guess I started in January of last year, and then Dennis stepped away in February, which kind of fueled my emotion even more. But at every basically door or lunch or coffee shop conversation I was having, it was, Robert, governments, both federal and provincial, have gone way too far left. We need to get back to the center because that's what we can afford. And, and today affordability is a big part. And I'm a centrist. And that's where I want to get back to because that's what's affordable. And people understand, as I said earlier, no is an answer when we can't afford it. And I guess it's
nobody likes to hear no.
No, I get that. And it was brought up. I heard it in some conversations this week. It's not no forever, but it's no, not right now. But this is something we can revisit down the way. We can't afford if we continue on the path that we're on, we may not have our sovereignty here.
I think the bond rating agencies will stop us if they haven't already. We'll see. But credit rating is not the best in Canada.
I'm not 100% sure where that lands today, but obviously there's a lot of pundits that tell me it's not good, it's not great. So at least if you can show you're going to make some, I'll say, significant fiscal changes that we can, we're going to try to work to get that under control. I think we can rebuild that relationship again.
So is there a defense, and I hear this, that, look, yes, we're spending, but every Western jurisdiction is overspending. You see the trillions of dollars in debt that the U.S., Federal Reserve, the government in the U.S. is overextending. Ontario, Nova Scotia, everybody's spending more than they should be. And that becomes, to me, an excuse or justification.
Yeah, exactly.
And I look at other jurisdictions, like the U.S., they're an economic engine. If they've overspent, they have the ability to correct that. Ontario, probably do. Nova Scotia probably does. I'm not sure PEI have the benefit of resources or other assets that can help us if we just perpetually spend beyond our means. Yeah.
Well, that's an excuse that I really hate hearing. Well, this is happening everywhere. But on Prince Edward Island, we have to live within our own means. I think is what you're driving at too. A little
everybody
bit.
Else has to. Yeah. The Islanders have to.
Yeah, we do. And you know what? You're right. We don't have that natural resource. We don't have the golds or silvers or
it'd
oil.
Be great. Metals yeah. would be great these days.
And maybe you know, optimistically, I like to be the optimist. Maybe we will find something that will make significant differences, like Newfoundland just indicated that they've got some new things on the go, which, and maybe we can do that. You know, we've always been, when we talk about our economic driver and finding new business and all that, you know, all those kind of measures. Yeah, let's get back on track there, see what we can do. We live in the best province, in the best country in the world, in my opinion. And I think, you know, if with a little bit of reinventing ourselves right here locally, I think we can really make great strides. You got to get buy-in. That's probably number one. But you can't get buy-in by hiding in your office down at the Jones Building or the Shaw Building. You got to get out in the public and meet with everybody and listen to where their vision is. Because lots of times there's good message out sure. there that yeah. just gets ignored, and then that creates frustration. Yeah. And that's where we are today. Frustrated Islanders who feel they haven't been listened to, they're just bypassed when it comes to good ideas. So the grassroots way of the Liberal Party has served me well over the last number of months, served me well for 14 years. It'll serve me well again in the future is my hope.
Well, Robert, it's a pleasure to have you onto the podcast today. I want to thank you for coming in and making your time available to listen to Islanders and communicate with Islanders. And we look forward to the feedback on our conversation today. Thanks so much, and I'll leave the parting words to you.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity to be here. Anytime I get a chance to kind of speak with Islanders, and I know that's where your audience is primarily Islanders that have concern about what's going on in Prince Edward Island, and I want them to know that myself as a leader of the opposition, Liberal Party, and the team that we're building will have your back, and we will listen to you, and we want to be your government after the next election.
Thanks very much, Robert. You can tune in to a new podcast every Thursday, and we look forward to getting feedback on this or any podcast that we have. Thanks very much.
Thank you.